Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, helping to raise awareness and help find a cure. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear those stories, including the Williams F1 team's planning director, Richard Jones, right now on your chosen podcast player. Also, bookings are still available for the Motormouth charity karting event with places on August the 10th still on general sale. Enter your team of four to an endurance race and compete with and against a host of motorsport celebs or pro drivers who will be drawn at random to be on your team. Gates open at 12:30 and close at 6 p.m. For all the information and to see who you could be up against, head to motormouthkartrace.com. We'll see you there, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumour. It's season 8 and we're really excited to be once again teaming up with F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula 1. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the pinnacle of motorsport. And let's face it, any chance to get close to Formula 1 this year, we are all over it. And the brilliant news is you can now return trackside thanks to F1 Experiences. Enjoy the very best race tickets and track hospitality, first class hotel, and unprecedented access you simply cannot get anywhere else. For more information on how you can book your F1 experience, visit f1experiences.com, where you can also save 5% on your very own F1 experiences package by using the code Motormouth when checking out online. So what are you waiting for? Experience the 2021 F1 season firsthand with exclusive access courtesy of F1 Experiences. Get booking today at f1experiences.com.
Hello everyone, Tim Sylvie here. Now today's guest was born in Heidelberg in Germany before a jet-setting life began. Racing and living all over the world, a stint in Monaco, then moving to Brazil and more accurately, the capital, Brasilia. And did you know, Harry Benjamin, that the city of Brasilia took just 41 months to build from 1956 to 1960 to replace Rio as the country's capital city, where it had been previously for the last 197 years. And furthermore, Brazil is the fifth largest country in the world by population, with over 210 million people over a geographical area of 3,287,597 square miles. It borders every South American nation, barring Ecuador and Chile, and makes up 47% of the continent. Did you know that?
I didn't, and I did A-level geography. So, you learn something new every day, as we do on this podcast. It's been a while since we've recorded one as well, so I've been missing your random facts at the start of each show.
Well, I'm glad to enlighten you. And I have to say, and this is becoming a regular thing now, and I can say it now. I know I can say it because by the time this is released, it would have already happened. You recently, fairly recently, made your commentary TV debut with Porsche and various others, various GTs and all sorts of different bits and pieces. But It's getting even more exciting because you're making your full F3 commentary debut soon. Well, this weekend, which at the time of recording will be Austria, replacing the brilliant Alex Jax. That must be scary.
So I haven't done it yet, but by the time this goes out, we'll find out if I've mucked it up or not. So we'll see how it goes. But yeah, I'll do the Formula 3, so that'll be really fun for the second part of the doubleheader in Austria. So really looking forward to that, and it's just cool to be shouting at fast cars. Who doesn't love to do that?
No, well, best of luck to you. Well, listen, shall we introduce today's guest?
I think so. He's achieved a bit more than I have.
So today we are joined by Nelson Piquet Jr., the man who won the first ever FIA Formula E Championship, beating former podcast guest Sebastian Buemi by a single point. He's a man with impressive racing heritage and the son of three-time Formula One world champion Nelson Piquet. He worked his way up from karting, F3, GP2, A1GP, one of my favourites, Formula One, NASCAR, and a sprinkling of Rallycross, and of course, Formula E. We're here to dive into his life, career, and opinions. Nelson Piquet Jr., a big welcome to the Motormouth Podcast.
Well, good afternoon or good morning. For me, it's good morning. So great to be here. And ready to bring up some memories and some interesting stories.
Thanks for joining us, Nelson. We really do appreciate it. You say it's morning there. Whereabouts are you joining us from?
I'm in São Paulo at the moment.
Very nice. And so, well, let's get straight back into it then. Let's open up memory lane, shall we, and go back to where it all began, if I may. You were born in Germany to a Dutch mother and, of course, former F1 world champion Nelson. So what was life like sort of initially growing up in Germany, Monaco, and then Brazil? So many different influences, I imagine, lots of different cultures. Were you aware as well of the high profileness of your father at that time? Talk us through the early stages before sort of getting into cars.
Well, yeah, not a typical, let's say, journey in the beginning for me. Going from one country to another, I mean, it wasn't that much. I mean, from till I was eight, grew up in South France, Monaco, sort of Monaco, South of France, because it wasn't inside Monaco, but it was really close to Monaco. And then when I was eight, went to Brazil, and when I was 16 or so, 17, I went to England. So. I didn't have, I think on one side, which is good, a lot of the drivers that come from far away from either it's Australia or Japan or Brazil or come all the way to England to live in England. It's sometimes it can be a pretty big, it's a big, not a shock, I would say, but you're far from your family, far from your friends. And, when you're, coming up in life and racing, doing all these steps from British F3, then to Formula 2, when you add, obviously it's already difficult for all of us young drivers to go through these steps. But, if you have family around or friends, sometimes you don't feel so much away from your comfort zone. When a Brazilian is coming to England or Japanese drivers coming all the way from Japan to stay to live in England, you add another level of difficulty, or I don't know what's the right word at the moment, but you add another level of obstacle, which is far away from your friends, different culture, different foods, different language, all these things which make it harder. I think for the non-European drivers, especially, I would say the Japanese drivers and maybe Brazilians or Argentinians, stuff like that. That's, I think they kind of suffer, I would say, but they have an extra struggle when they come to a country like England, which for many years, that was the path that we needed to do to arrive in F1. It was harder for us, It's different when you get a French driver, he just gets a plane or gets a car and he crosses the border, he's in England, or even Italy, in 2 hours he's there, you know, any, you know, anybody in Europe. But then you get a Japanese culture or a Latin, Brazilian, Australian, Argentinian, Bolivian, anywhere here in South America, and you go all the way to Europe, you know, okay, it's not an end of the world flying for 10 hours, but still you're facing with different languages, different cultures, different food, you know, and that ends up adding up to already the difficult task that you have.
Yeah.
So going back to the reason why I'm saying this, to your original question, I think I was, in a way, I was lucky to have, you know, born in Germany, Dutch mother, living in France, and I went to Brazil and then moving back to England, because that step was hard for me, obviously. But probably if I would have been born in Brazil, raised my whole life in Brazil, and then leave Brazil to go to England, probably that would have been, you know, a step harder for me. So I think in a way I didn't create as many roots as a lot of people do with their own country. So if tomorrow, let's say, I would have to be living in the States or back in Europe or Japan, Australia, wherever, I wouldn't feel as homesick, let's say, as a person that would have been born somewhere and would have been raised, and then after 16, 17, 18 years, going to have to, having to leave to a different continent and, you know, start your life there.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. We were talking to Alex Brundle a few weeks ago, and about his life growing up and his dad having, you know, sort of a conveyor belt of incredible names wandering through his house as a youngster. What was it like? Did you realize the stature of your father when you were growing up? And was it fairly normal to you to be in a paddock or surrounded by other well-known racing drivers of the time?
Well, again, I mean, it's a bit difficult, a bit different from the example in Europe, because let's say if my dad we would be living in Europe, or if we were from a European, let's say, country, I probably would have been seeing much more of this. I would have been seeing much more friends of my father. I would have been maybe surrounded by this world a little bit more, like you said, of the Brundle family. In our case, because my father went back to Brazil and I was in Brazil, well, who the hell is going to go all the way to Brazil to visit us, you know, from, let's say, from the current, at that time, F1 paddock. So maybe the F1 Grand Prix, we would go there and, you know, you would see a bunch of people, but that was the only moment really that we saw stuff, you know? So again, it's something that we're so far away from this reality of F1 when we're in Brazil, that for me, when I went to England and when I had my first F1 test at Silverstone and all these kind of things, you know, that was wow. You know, I mean, I think maybe for someone that is, I don't know, let's get a Lewis, for example, you know, he grew up in England and then obviously going to F1 races as a kid, even as a spectator or as a guest for McLaren after he became a McLaren driver. So maybe for this example, for him, as for example, it was much more of a shock, you know. For me, you know, just by going inside Silverstone, inside that huge track, which had so much history, was already, you know, gave us already butterflies in the stomach. Plus doing a race there and then having big events like F1 races, that all of those things was always such a wow, you know. It would, you know, I feel that maybe for you guys that live there every day, that are there day in, day out, you know, it's just one more day. Yeah. Obviously not exactly that, but still the impressions that you guys probably would feel by going inside Silverstone, it wasn't the same feeling from us coming all the way from Brazil and going to Silverstone for the first time.
It's fascinating, isn't it, actually, what you say there? Because you don't see all that that hard work. I mean, we know about the hard work and struggle that it takes already to be a racing driver, but then just adding in, you know, if you're not in Europe, it just makes everything 10 times harder, doesn't it, if you're coming across here. But moving into cars and entering this motorsport world, I'm curious to know, was there any other option for you, or was it always you were going to be a racing driver? That was just never questioned.
Well, my father was all... You know, the one thing that he's, well, harsh on, I would say, is that, I mean, he's always left. I mean, we're a family of seven kids. We're two girls and five boys.
Wow.
And I'm the only one that still races. And my father was always very clear in that regards. I'll always help you to do whatever you want to do as long as you love what you're doing. And, you know, I had, out of the five boys, four of them tried it, and, you know, most recently Pedro. And, you know, they end up, for different reasons, they didn't continue. And my father was always, in that way, was very strict, you know, or you love what you do. It doesn't matter how good you are, how bad you are, whatever it is, I'll always help you to, you know, to follow your dreams, to do something with the sports. But you need to love what you do. And I had something sickening about racing, you know. It was, that was the only thing I thought about and wanted to do. And there wasn't, obviously, there wasn't a doubt about it, because even when I lived in South of France and my parents were divorced since I was born, practically, I obviously must have been a influence of my mother, but I was always, let's say, playing with race cars, whether it was in a dining table or something like that. I mean, playing with them. And I was not the kind of kid which I was playing with that because I was watching Netflix, F1 drivers, that kind of stuff. Obviously, we didn't have any of that, you know. I mean, what I would have were those VHS cassettes, which I have over here in the closet, that I would watch, like, the crazy crashes of, you know, of 1980s, you know. So you would see the British touring cars, and you would see a mixture of F1 and all kinds of different stuff. But it wasn't like I started watching F1, like paying attention at the race from beginning to the start. I'm going to say probably after I was in F3, because before that it was boring. It was the Michael era where he was winning everything, and races were long and boring compared to a go-kart race, and then they were compared to a F3 race later on, you know? So I always run away from these questions. I don't remember what the question was anymore now, but...
We'll take that. No, but
what was the original question? Let me just finish.
It was basically, you know, was there any other option?
Oh, gotcha. Sorry. So growing up in Europe, not going to any racetracks, I was always playing with these cars. And the moment I got in Brazil, I didn't even speak Portuguese. So my languages were French and English at the time. And my father, obviously, first thing, he had recently just had the Indy 500 accident. So he was recently started his company, getting off the crutches that he still had at the time. And he said, he brought me to a go-kart track. I said, "That's Nelson, you want to give it a try?" I had no idea what I was doing. He was still speaking English with me while, you know, he had to translate things from me to the mechanic. Well, there was not much I was going to say, but I started driving, and I don't remember much, to be honest, from those days. I don't know why, but I have a terrible memory for this. But my father found a mechanic that he ended up trusting, because my father was working so hard in those days, starting up his company that he still has till today. He had no time. I mean, he was there the first time with me, and then he said, okay, he found a mechanic that he trusted, that he could pick me up from school or could organize my go-kart. And from that day onwards, I was every day from Monday to Friday after school going there, like if it was football practice, you know. I mean, I was always driving. And the first couple of months when I didn't speak Portuguese yet, was only, you know, when you're a kid, you pick up the language quickly. But I was a stubborn kid and I didn't speak Portuguese. So at the end of practice, when it was getting dark, the only way to stop me was to putting fuel in the go-kart, the right amount of fuel for it to finish when it was going to get dark. So they would say, okay, we have another half an hour. Let's fill up the tank and let him go, because he'll drive and he won't stop. They would try to stop me in the track when it was getting dark. And I was stubborn and was, I don't know what was wrong with me, but I wouldn't stop. So I would only stop when would run out of fuel. And then I would cry, do a tantrum, whatever. The driver would take me back home. And then it was like that until I started learning the language and understood that at one point I couldn't drive anymore. You know, I had to go back home. So, and it's been like that, you know. I think my father saw that and didn't see that in probably most of the kids, my brothers, that, you know, it wasn't that level of craziness about wanting to race. And that's why he's always supported me through my career, I would say.
That's really nice, a really nice story to hear. And it's great to hear of a racing driver with such passion, because let's be honest, not all racing drivers, not all people who are racing have that deep-rooted passion. I'm not going to name any names, but there are drivers who may come from a privileged background, or like you have a father in the sport, who just seem to do it for a hobby and have all the money in the world they need to do it, but don't have that drive that can really push them on to success.
Yeah, I mean, just completing a little bit what you're talking about, I mean, what drives me crazy sometimes, and you see it on TV all the time, is these drivers that made it for F1, made it to F1 because of sponsors or because of different various reasons. And if for whatever reason, it didn't work out, or didn't get the sponsors they needed to continue in F1 or this and that, which they were spending, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 million pounds. And then the next year, they don't do anything.
Yeah.
They didn't do an IndyCar, they didn't do a DTM, they don't do whatever it is. You, just because your credentials you had in F1 for 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever, how many seasons you did, even if it was one, I mean, your chances of getting something somewhere else are much better, you know, especially when you're freshly out of F1, you can do other stuff. And the amount of drivers that I see, didn't work out on F1, I don't want to do it anymore. It just it blows my mind away, because I was like, guys, I mean, are you an F1 for the fame, for just because to be in the paddock, or do you want to race?
Yeah.
I mean, real drivers need to want to race. Yeah, F1 is the top of where everybody dreams to be. But do you love racing, or you love being an F1 driver? You know, there's two, and I see that more frequently than I would like to, because it's a bit sad, because, you know, I mean, come on. To be an F1 driver, you need to have that passion, you need to have that dedication, and you need to have it needs to be what you want to do more than anything else in the world to achieve there. It's so competitive and so difficult to get there, you know. And then you see these drivers that have maybe they got some easier opportunities, they have found a sponsor or whatever it is, and then all of a sudden, if they don't have the sponsor anymore, they cannot be an F1.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything else anymore, you know, and that's just crazy.
It is, and it's funny. There's, you know, one guy who I was involved with a lot for his F1 career, Max Chilton, who I have criticized for certain things that he's done, but equally, to his credit, what he did do was, after Formula One, when he left the sport under difficult circumstances, he didn't hang up his boots. He even took a massive step back and went to Indy Lights before getting eventually to IndyCar. And okay, Max has got a lot of money behind him, everyone knows that. But equally, at least he had the humbleness to be able to go, okay, well, I've left F1, I'm going to do Indy Lights, and I don't really care what people think, but I'm racing. You know, credit to him for that.
I don't know if you know that, but I actually replaced him in the Toronto Indy Lights race in 2016, I think it was.
Yeah.
I think, I'm pretty sure he had Le Mans, or he had some kind of race.
No, wasn't it?
It would have been that Nissan project.
It was the Nissan LMP1 project.
Maybe the Nissan project. And he missed the race. He missed the Toronto Indy Lights race. And Trevor called me, said, Nelson, would you fancy doing Indy Lights? I was like, yes. Where? When? Just tell me where to be. And so I got to Toronto. I'd never been to Toronto. I'd never been in Indy Lights race. And I got the pole. first time there, I started on pole. I was winning the race. And if you guys want to Google it, put it on. I don't know if you guys put some images here or not. But I don't know, 10 laps into the race or something, this, I don't know, Jack something, one of these drivers, I closed the door, and he just, I don't know what the hell was going through his head, but he just hit the back of my car and flipped upside down, nearly hit one of the bridges of the racetrack, and that was the end of my race. And it was a shame, but I was gonna win my first and only Indy Lights race in Max's car.
I remember this because Max, we were sort of expecting Max to jump into Indy Lights and just smash it, just win, and he didn't. So it was a little bit awkward, but. And then Nelson came into Max's car and stuck it on pole straight away. It's a bit like, oh, bloody hell. Like, Max has been sort of getting the odd pole here and there, but not winning all the races. And, you know, I'm not sure when he actually won a race in Indy Lights, but we were kind of like, oh, great. Nelson's come in, sat in Max's car and gone and stuck it on pole straight away. It makes us all look a bit stupid. But it's a good series. And I love the whole Indy Lights into IndyCar thing. I think they're doing brilliant stuff over there. And I'm a massive IndyCar fan. And we'll talk about your US racing a little bit later. But I want to pick up on British F3, where you came across to. Where you were immediately on it, and I think I'm right in saying you won it in 2004 ahead of Adam Carroll, who incidentally was it Adam that said Nelson was, it was either Timo Glock or Adam Carroll, because we quiz drivers on who the best person is that they've raced against, and your name cropped up. I can't remember whether it was Tino.
Yeah, Adam Carroll was very complimentary, but also bitter. But complimentary. Yeah.
But that period earned you that test with Williams. What was that like? How did that opportunity come about? And what was it like the first time you sat inside a full-blown Formula One car?
Geez. I mean, at the time, the F3 cars, they were more in the same kind of culture of my dad's, you know, hard tires, tight tracks, just a very different kind of driving skills from F1. You know, I think nowadays, as much as the F3 is, some people criticize it a lot compared to the old F3 cars, it's heavier, it's this and that, but it is more similar to what you're going to face in F2 and in F1, you know, softer tires, super high degradation, you know. So, you know, in a way, I understand that, you know, it's making the driver's life a bit easier by having a more similar car to what they're going to face later on. And at those days, hard tires, the tracks in England, which, you know, you guys know how it is, it was so different from F1. I mean, I'm telling you, I honestly trained as much as I could before the F1 test, and it was just so much quicker, so different that it was just a bit too quick at the beginning. You know, the jump was too big from going from, I don't know, 200 something horsepower, 220 horsepower to 800 V10 engine. You know, it was. Just too crazy. And it was so, for me, it was, you know, I couldn't keep calm. I was just, every time I accelerate, I mean, it was just holding my head to try to not fall off. And it wasn't natural enough for me to be able to concentrate purely on the driving and not having to deal with all the speed and this G-force. Yeah.
Did you, after that testing, did you suddenly start to feel, though, although you felt like it was still quite a big jump at the time, what followed was then in 2005, obviously a move up to GP2 and you won in Spa as well, then got another test for BAR Honda in Formula One. And then the following year, you came second to Lewis Hamilton. Were you feeling like you were in a really good kind of momentum at that stage? You've had some F1 tests behind you. You know, Lewis Hamilton was obviously just ahead at the time. People bigging him up for good things. And of course, I suppose you might have seen that at the same time, but you were up there with him as well. Were you thinking, right, okay, I'm in a really good position here. I'm ready for F1.
Well, you never know when you're ready for F1 because you don't know what to expect. But in terms of speed and confidence with the car, definitely after my F3 days, me and my teammate from GP2 or F2, Shandy Negrao, we bought a old world Nissan car. Which the time Super Nissan, which you guys probably know about. I don't know how long you guys know motorsports, but it was a great championship they had back in the early 2000s. We bought one of those old cars because it had a lot of power, big tires, a lot of downforce, and we said let's share the car and let's go testing. And that helped me a lot because when I started in GP2, you know, I got used to the car quicker because, you know, by then I had done maybe at least 5 days of testing on this world Nissan and the Super Nissan car and different tracks. Like we went to Nürburgring, remember, Budapest, went to a couple of tracks, I think in Spain somewhere. So it gave me some baggage when the GP2 thing started that, you know, I knew how to deal with all that power. And and so I did the first GP2 season, which was an okay season, nothing special. I had a win, a couple of podiums. We had PK Sports at the time as well. You cannot forget that factor, which was a local team for us. You know, I had a Brazilian engineer, some Brazilian mechanics mixed with some British mechanics. But we were against ART, we were against Arden, we were against iSports, all these brilliant minds in Europe that's, you know, that have been dominating the Formula 3000, then, you know, those eras of big cars, which it wasn't easy to beat. You know, we had just beaten a lot of famous teams in England in British F3, like Fortec, Trevor Carlin, P1 Motorsports that was with Adam Carroll, a bunch of, you know, a lot of good teams. And now we were facing Formula 2. And right before when the first season of GP2 started, when the first season of GP2 ended, I remember that was when A1GP started. And by then I had, you know, a season of GP2, a couple of tests of World Nissan, the car we bought. I had had probably the Williams test, and I don't know if I had the BAR test already done by then. But when I jumped in the A1GP car, you know, it was just so easy for me. You know, I mean, I knew so much what I was doing with that kind of power, that kind of car. And they were having a tryout with a couple of Brazilian drivers. I remember it was Danilo Durrani, Carpatozo, a couple of drivers that were still maybe a step behind me doing the F3 things. Maybe João Paulo de Oliveira, the Brazilian guy that races in Japan. I think he probably had done some the Nippon series over there, but they were all testing, and I was the last one to jump in the car. And when I jumped in the car, I was all of a sudden, I think 0.7 seconds quicker than everybody else, and it was a no brainer for them. They picked me, but I was at that point between the end of 2005, beginning of 2006, which was my second GP2 year. I was really well, you know, when 2006, when the GP2 season started in Valencia, and then when Lewis was there with ART, which was the best team, you know, we won the first race by a long way. Second race, we did very well. We were leading the championship in the beginning with a good margin. It was only when halfway through the 2006 season, which I got really sick. And a lot of people don't know this, but I developed that hay fever allergies, which probably half of your country has it, but it's something that I'd never had. You know, I went to England in 2003, 3, 4, 5, never had nothing. Fine. All of a sudden, I developed this hay fever allergy, which I had no idea what it was. I don't know if it was a flu. I don't know if it was COVID at the time, whatever it was, because I was literally, I mean, my eyes were swollen. I couldn't stop sneezing and I couldn't sleep well. And this lasted in summer in the June, July or period which was Le Mans, which I did Le Mans as well in 2006, my first Le Mans appearance. And It took me a month to figure out that I had these allergies, but I didn't know how to deal with this. And it, you know, at the beginning I thought it was just sneezing, but I'm not feeling sick, so I don't know what it is. And then my eyes would start itching, and then the terrible mistake, you put your hands in your eyes and you're doing this, and then it became all worse. And oh, it was just a nightmare. And after, obviously, I found out that I had this allergy, that I had developed it. Okay, well, what's the medicine to take? Well, there is medicine, but most of them you cannot take it because of the doping tests in F1 or in GP2. Plus, and I don't know if this is with you guys, if you face this, but it's not like you get 100% relief when you take Zyrtex and these kind of things. It helps you a little bit, but the big secret that I've learned through the last 20 years dealing with this freaking allergy is basically staying in indoors in air conditioning, not putting your hands in your eyes, washing your hands all the time, trying to use sunglasses when you're outside. And that's the best way to say. And anyway, sorry, I'm going into these details of information, but
no, it's brilliant.
So I, for about 6 to 8 weeks, I suffered so much. And that's what the Silverstone race was during Le Mans. And it was another GP2 race somewhere else, which I should have done much better than I did. But because I was with my mind so sick and not knowing, not being able to deal with this, it hurt me a lot. I lost a lot of performance in that period until I finally figured out what I had.
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, F1 Experiences. F1 Experiences offer a wide range of packages that come direct from Formula One, giving you a unique experience of the pinnacle of motorsport. Official ticket packages come with the very best race tickets, first-class hotels and transfers, and unprecedented access, including track tours, pit lane walks, VIP hospitality, and loads more. It really is the closest you can get to Formula One, and thanks to F1 Experiences, you can return to the track this year, and Motormouth listeners can save 5% on your next F1 Experiences package by using the code Motormouth when booking online at f1experiences.com.
You can't say the Motormouth podcast doesn't cover all elements of of motorsport, including hay fever. And you're absolutely right. The moment you put your hands in your eyes, which feels amazing at the time when you're scratching around, it's like, yes, this is heaven. The moment you take your hands away, yes, it's the worst thing on the planet.
Exactly.
I'm totally with you. Also, as an aside, Nelson, spoke to Adam Carroll about this. A1GP, brilliant championship, needs to be brought back. I've got amazing plans for it. I'm thinking sustainable racing, men and women racing against each other, bring it all back. Team Brazil, Team U, it's going to happen. So just putting it out there, when you get bored of racing, let's get together and bring it back. Okay, I'm just going to leave that there. We'll park that one there.
It's funny. I just brought my, I was in, obviously my father lives in Brasilia still, and I'm living in São Paulo, and I have literally crap, and Rebecca can confirm that with you guys because she's still working with me, all around the world. Obviously, I've lived in, you know, went from Brazil to Europe, to America, back to Europe, back to Brazil. So I have storages everywhere. I'm starting now to bring all the pile of crap, of trophies, helmets, cars over here to São Paulo, because I have a couple of businesses over here, and I'm, instead of having a house which I cannot even step on the floor because there's stuff everywhere, I decided, well, I'm going to put stuff in my restaurant because it's my restaurant, and you know, I'm going to use it to put some of my helmets, my trophies. Oh, I have a go-kart track. Well, I might as well make a little mini museum and put some of my stuff. And one of the cars, one of the last things I picked up from my move was a Skill 1-8 Amalgam A1GP car that I had back in the day, and such a beautiful car. Oh, it was such a good championship. We had so much fun. I unfortunately didn't finish the championship because I wanted to focus on GP2. And but yeah, I mean, oh, I had a lot of fun, and I was also the first winner of the two first races in Brands Hatch, which were against, you know, not the least, but Adam Carroll, Will Power, Robbie Kerr. I mean, you name it, the guys that were racing there that are still racing nowadays.
It's coming back. Tim's going to make sure of that.
I'm going to bring it back. I've already reached out to Mark Gallagher. I'm like, listen, we need to make this happen. I've got a whole business plan laid out for it. You'll be hearing from me by Rebecca. One thing I wanted to cover before we come on to the quiz, and we asked this of a lot of people, is who is the best you've ever raced against? Who's the best you've ever shared a track with?
For sure, Fernando. Fernando, he was a tough guy to beat. I think I was in a very tough spot. He was he had just won a world championship. He had fire inside his pants. He wanted to, you know, destroy everything he could see in front of him. And he was in his days, you know. I mean, nowadays, you know, he's one of the oldest guys in the paddock, and he's still making Ocon. You know, I mean, in the beginning, I was pretty surprised with Ocon. And I said, well, Ocon obviously is a good driver, and probably Fernando doesn't have that fire that he used to have obviously 15 years ago or how many years ago. And but I don't know what happened. I mean, I haven't followed it that close. To I've seen the results, seen a couple of laps, but you know, Fernando still seems to be, you know, the guy to beat against even the young guys, you know.
Absolutely.
You obviously made it to Formula One, which must have been an absolute elation for you when that dream came true, and it's obviously been well documented, but do you miss it?
Well, not really, because well, you miss things that you enjoyed, or you miss some, I mean, everybody dreams of being an F1. And, you know, I unfortunately, in the, let's say, 3 years that I was there, I didn't really, I mean, the first year was fun because I was a test driver, had to go to all the races, didn't have to do anything, met a lot of girls, had a lot of fun. I had just started to drink at those days. You know, it took me a while to start drinking. You know, when I first moved to England, I wasn't drinking yet. And so, you know, I think in that year of 2006 to 2007, that's when I started to found out what vodka Red Bull was back in the day. And because I didn't enjoy wine. I didn't enjoy champagne. I just didn't like the taste of it. And then vodka Red Bull, oh, this is interesting. And then, you know, how much it made you go through the night. It was pretty awesome. So, so I had a lot of fun that year. Must say that it was pretty spectacular year. Obviously, I would have preferred to be racing, but I just had to hang around and just show my face. So, you know, but then, yeah, obviously the two seasons were tough because, you know, I wasn't in the best environment. You know, F1 was in a weird time. It wasn't like nowadays, which in my opinion, F1 is in a much better moment than they were in those days. It was Netflix, was all there. I think Netflix made a big difference for them. But it's just the commercial package that they're having, you know, all those drivers that they're there nowadays, they're real stars. I feel that in my days, Bernie had it so secured and so kept away from the public, you know, that you know, F1 was, wow, was something so far away, but at the same time, nobody really knew, it was just what you would see in TV, and that was it. You know, I think you have so much more content at the moment that it makes, at the same time that it unveils a lot of the mysteries that what it was, but at the same time, it creates much more interest for the people because they know the characters, you know, they know what the drivers are, where they live, what they like. And so it creates much more interest, basically. So in my days, you didn't have any of that. And so going back to your question, I think it wasn't really fun because I was getting beat by Fernando. Obviously, it's not that, you know, it's not easy to beat him. But, you know, me as a driver had beaten all my teammates and won everything till I get there. And plus, the environment was tough. You know, I mean, I didn't have what nowadays drivers doing the right thing, which was a cushion lawyer or let's say manager at the time. You know, nowadays the right thing to do, and what I recommend to any drivers, you need a political manager, which you'll get the Jean Todt, the Nicholas Todt, all that kind of crap, which they're completely political. And then involved in the politics of the sport, I mean. And then you have those guys, which are, for example, the cousin of Carlos Sainz, or, you know, or in Max's case, he doesn't need to manage it. He has, I forgot the name of his manager, but guys that they can trust for life, you know?
Yeah.
So it's two different things. You need maybe a guy that is going to know what's going to happen in the paddock and do the right moves. And because he's politically connected, he'll put you in the right place. But then also you need, between you and that guy, you need the guy that is only looking at what's good for you. Because these guys, they'll sign as many drivers as they can. What they're looking for is money, you know, these political guys. So so that's the issue which we faced. I think my father at the time thought that he could trust Flavio and thought that he could, oh, Nelson's in good hands. And that's it. Here's Nelson. Take care of him and blah, blah, blah. That was it. But we didn't think in the factor that, you know, Flavio had as many drivers as he could have. You know, he's always going to look on his best interest, not on the driver's best interest. And that was our mistake. You know, it was so going back, you know, I know where you guys are going. I just want to make the whole picture. You know, it was tough times because it was very competitive. I had a lot of pressure on top of me and I didn't have anybody really looking at what was good for me, you know, for my health, for my mental health. You know, I didn't have that kind of person really looking out for me in those ways.
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. And it's funny, actually, a weird connection that I have to you that you obviously won't be aware of is that at that time when you were with Renault, that was quite early on in my Formula One career. I've worked in driver management and on the commercial side of things for many years. And that was one of my first big exposures to Formula One. And I was managing the ING Bank sponsorship of the Renault F1 team, where I was wearing those horrible bright orange trousers and the white polo shirt, looking like a clown in the paddock. And I'm pretty sure at one point I even gave you a ride on the back of a scooter for some reason to some sort of hospitality event or something or other. So it's funny to be talking to you now in this capacity. And I think everybody knows the dramas that unfolded in Singapore. We're not going to go into it because I think, you know, you've said your piece on that. We don't need to say anymore. It's been covered a million times. And as you say, it was a difficult period of your career. I don't think we need to brush through that. I do think we need to brush through that and brush over it. So we're going to ignore that part of your career completely and come to a much more important piece, which is the Motormouth podcast. Over to you, the Motormouth quiz, rather. Harry Benjamin, over to you, my friend.
It is Nelson Piquet Jr. Welcome to the middle part of the show, which is the Motor Mouth Quiz. It's the hardest quiz in motorsport. We have a very long leaderboard of about, everybody who's ever taken part in the podcast, which is reaching 80 plus now. So it's a long old leaderboard. There are 14 points up for grabs. I have, how many questions? We have 4 questions and a bonus question for you. But they're all about you and your career. So you should be able to hopefully answer them. You're going to hear a couple of clips as well. It's essentially all you have to do is have a listen and then provide a little bit of context for us. And if I'm feeling generous, I'll just give you all the points. Are you ready for your first question?
I hope so.
Okay. All right. Well, the first question is actually a short clip. Have a listen to this.
Here we go.
Congratulations, guys. Can't believe we did it. I knew, I felt this weekend was ours. I knew it. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you.
So, Long Beach.
Yes. Oh, I don't have to ask you. You've got Long Beach. What was the year and what happened?
It was our first Formula E win. I think I was 14, 15, which I was already 15, I would say. But it was the first season of Formula E, obviously. Long Beach. I know exactly what I was feeling over there. I remember like it was yesterday.
Amazing. Well, you've gotten off to a brilliant start. That's 3 points in the bag straight away. We're going to come on to a bit of Formula E stuff just in a moment. Second question, though, for you. Can you name, you obviously won the championship for what was Team China Racing, NextEV. Can you name all the incarnations of that team and what they were called right up from the very start of Formula E to what they're called now? And I'll give you a hint. There are 4 different names I'm looking for.
Sorry, I didn't pick up your question. The incarnations?
Basically the different names of what was initially China Racing up till modern day. So what had they been called throughout the years? I'm looking for 4 different team names.
Tough.
Okay, so China Racing.
Yeah, you can have that one.
NextEV.
Yes.
Neo. And
and so the current form of it today, which is Neo, but there's a little something extra as well.
Neo 333 or Neo. Yeah,
got it in one. Well done. You're actually, we've talked to a couple of drivers who've been through that team, and the current manager Christian Silt, and not even they are able to do that. So so well done. You're onto a blinder so far. 6 out of 6 points available so far. Okay, we've got another clip for you to listen to now. Have a listen to this.
Here we go.
I don't know what to say. I mean, we tried so hard.
London.
My God, I cannot believe
last race. Championship race.
Easy.
He's got it. That was easy, wasn't it? Another 3 points on the board.
Easy.
We will talk about that, I promise you. One more question before your bonus point. How many podiums, including wins, did you get in the first season of Formula E?
How many? 5 podiums.
Correct.
Formula E, first season, correct. Yeah.
Well done. And for 1 extra bonus point, this is looking good, Nelson. You could go to the very top of the leaderboard here. Can you name the teams that your dad won his F1 World Championships with?
Well, Brabham and Williams.
Yeah, so, correct. He's got it all in there. For one bonus point, Nelson Piquet Jr. I don't think it was too easy, but maybe. Either way.
It was too easy. Come on. I thought you were going to say how many podiums you had in your British F3 first season or something like that.
Oh, God, no. That would have been hard work on both our sides, I think. But you've done amazingly there, and you've gone to the very top of the leaderboard. So you are our new leader. You have displaced Lee McKenzie, Alexander Sims, Dilbert Gill, Connor Daly. You're all way ahead of them. We've got the likes of... Well, who else have we got on here? We've got Sebastian Buemi. He's only down in 20th position with 11 points. So you've absolutely smashed it there, Nelson.
Beat him again.
Well done. You've beat him again. And actually, that seems like a good segue to talking about your time in Formula E. Obviously, I imagine there's a mix of memories. Obviously, some very, very good memories here in Formula E. How, taking it back to the start of Formula E especially, what did you think of it going in? What was the first thing you heard about it and what that made you go, oh, okay, that could be interesting?
Well, like we're talking about the whole manager bullshit politic things, you know, and obviously I had learned a hard lesson, and so I promised myself I'm going to work with someone that I trust. Maybe it's someone that is not politically correct, politically connected well, but I don't care. I mean, I need to be with someone I trust. And Steve Hewitt at the time, and when I went to the States, he was working for Alpine Stars. You know, he was the driver's rep for Alpine Stars, and we got on really well together and this and that. And I felt that he wanted to do something else. He wanted to, you know, get out of Alpine Stars and do something fun, something more challenging. I said, you're going to be my manager next year. And he was like, bullshit, whatever. I'm never going to be your manager and this and that, whatever. And, you know, he was living in California. He was going to all the NASCAR races. I was seeing him every weekend. You're going to be my manager. You're going to be my manager. End of the season. Nelson, are you sure want to do that? Yeah, I'm sure I want to do it. Well, he became my manager and it was really fun. We had a great time together. So anyway, the reason I'm coming into this was because I was doing at the time, Rallycross, you know, and he was helping me out. We're trying to find sponsors and helping out with the deals. And then Steve said, hey, Nelson, there's this electric series starting up, you know, Formula E with Alejandro and this and that. I said, well, I know Alejandro pretty well and this and that. You know, from the GP2 days, he had a GP2 team together with mine. And, you know, I'll give Alejandro a call. So I gave Alejandro a call, didn't pick up. I said, well, Steve, I cannot speak with Alejandro. He doesn't reply to my messages or anything like that. And he says, well, let me try to get a few calls. So I remember Steve got a call with Alan Prost, which was the EDAMS team at the time. We spoke to him and he said, Nelson, well, I would really want to make a team with you and Nico. I said, well, that sounds interesting. Come to England. So I went to England, went to an event, we talked. Yeah. And then a couple of days later, Nelson, we're struggling. Obviously, it's going to be Renault and the manufacturer. And I said, look, I understand. I know that it's very corporate, these kind of things. You know, I said, don't worry about it. It's fine. And then Steve kept, you know, looking for something else. Then we end up speaking to Venturi. And so Venturi said, yeah, come to Monaco. We would like to talk. We'd love to talk to you. So I went to Monaco, had a meeting, was great. And then, no, amazing, let's do it. And all of a sudden, they disappeared. I was like, what the fuck? Well, why are these people like this, you know? I mean, they tell us to fly all the way to Monaco, and then they disappear. And then Steve called me a couple of days later, said, Nelson, I think I know what's going on. Obviously, you know, Alejandro, you know, probably is very close friends with Flavio. You know, there's Lucas is involved, which is not a big fan of yours either, and this and that. I'm sure we're getting politically cock blocked, let's say, you know. And I was like, oh, fuck, whatever. You know, I said, well, whatever, this electric series, you know, we don't know what it's going to be about and this and that. Anyway, 2 weeks later, and then testing starts. You know, I kind of followed from the States. I look at the tests going on, and, you know, Steve actually goes there to Donington. And Steve called me from there. Nelson, I have this opportunity with Adrian Campos and China Racing. I said, what the fuck is China Racing? It's a team from a Chinese guy, whatever. This. I said, look, Steve, why we're going to go all the way to England, spend a week and spend money and this and that. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, whoever is cock blocking us is going to, well, I spoke to Adrian about that. And he said that, you know, it's a bit different. You know, a lot of these big teams, they were having a lot of financial help from Formula E to convince them to come to the series. So in a way, Formula E had a bit of a say on who to pick as a driver. And I was like, well, fair enough. You know, and China Racing doesn't have anything. You know, China Racing was sort of a spot that was left, you know, left open. And Alejandro kind of, with all his connections around the world, convinced a Chinese guy to, you know, come and run it. I said, fine, okay, let's not make sure we're going to get cock blocked, but yeah, let's do it then. So I fly into England for the last 2 days of testing before going to Hong Kong. And so I tested. The team was extremely disorganized. They had no idea what was going on. Energy saving was something that was not even going through our minds. We're instead of thinking about energy saving, we were tweaking about bars and front wing and springs and all that kind of crap, which doesn't make a difference when you're in the, I mean, it does, but that's not the most important thing. But anyway, we were there, testing finished, and everything was sort of, okay, Nelson, we would like to have, we're going to have you. And I think the other driver was, I don't know if it was Hoping Tung or Charles Pick, the first one.
I think it was sort of revolving door, wasn't there at that point?
Yeah, I think it was
Garcia
Hoping
as well.
He tested, yes, he did test, okay. But not with me. He tested before I arrived.
Okay.
But anyway, I think it was Hoping, the driver. So Adrian went, look, Nelson, fine. I think we're gonna keep you to start the season with. And everything seems okay. I said, well, okay, fine. We're not gonna be able to pay you much, but you know, it is what it is. Let's try to make a good job. There's a lot of prize money in F Formula E, so let's try to, you know, maybe you can use this prize money as your salary. I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. I don't know, a couple of hours in that same day, Lucas Degrassi, he shows up with a Swiss driver, which had, I don't know, a check of 3 million euros in his pocket, said, Adrian, I have this driver for you and replace Nelson and you need the money and this and that. So I don't know what was going on in the background. So a couple of hours later, Adrian calls me and said, Nelson, we have an issue over here. I said, what is it? Well, as you know, this team obviously doesn't have sponsor. I mean, it's a private guy from China that is putting the money to do this. You know, we're kind of on a tight budget. I said, yeah, okay. So the issue is that, you know, Lucas came over here and he found a driver that has quite a lot of money. I said, oh, great. I knew that was going to happen. And he said, but me, Adrian Campos, I'm a racer. I do want to, you know, as much as it's going to be difficult for us, I do think, you know, we need a good driver over here to be able to win. And I was like, yeah, okay, so let's sign me. He said, well, but unfortunately, the Chinese guy knows that there's this check of 2-3 million euros over here and he doesn't want to let go of it. So the only thing I can tell him to try to convince him and say, look, I mean, Nelson is a better driver. He has a bit of sponsorship, but we need to keep it. We need to try to keep him. I said, look, Adrian, championship starts in a month. You know, the cars are packing up tomorrow to go. I mean, how the hell you want me to find sponsorship now? I mean, it's, you know, if I knew this, I wouldn't even have come over here, you know? And then luckily I had Steve with me and when I was in NASCAR, you know, Steve was still working for Alpine Stars and Steve was, you know, obviously doing my race suits at Alpine Stars and stuff like that. He had worked a lot with Qualcomm, that big company, technology company from California. And Qualcomm was one of the sponsors of Formula E in the beginning. And Steve was, Nelson, who do you know from Qualcomm? I said, well, I know a couple of people over there. I said, well, they're over here. Let's go speak to them. It's like, well, I don't know, Steve. I mean, so I go through my contacts and I try to find the person from Qualcomm. I speak to the person. Hey, who's the person in charge for Qualcomm doing this Formula E project? Oh, this is the person, Cynthia. Okay, so I call Cynthia. Cynthia, are you in Donington? Yeah, I'm in Donington. Can I meet you? Where are you? So I meet the person at the racetrack. I said, look, I'm Nelson. I've worked with you. I've been sponsored by you guys in Formula 3 in Brazil, in British F3, won the championship with you guys there. I've been in NASCAR races with you guys. Oh, really? And this, the company is so big that she didn't really know it. But, you know, I was showing her pictures. And I said, look, I really, you know, I would love to be part of the series, you know, but I need to bring a sponsor. Wouldn't you guys be interested in being involved with me? And she was like, well, you know, we're already sponsoring the series and this and that. We might be able to do something, but it's going to be from January onwards. I was like, and the season started in August, September, something like that, you know? I was like, can we get a contract? He said, yeah. And these big companies, they're so slow to do everything. I mean, to get a contract of a company like Qualcomm, it took me forever. Anyway, but she had agreed. She had verbally and on email, she had sort of said, yeah, okay, we can agree for, I don't remember the amount, X amount, which was probably half of what Adrian had asked us for. And I went to Steve. I said, look, Steve, what shall we do? I mean, we kind of got an okay for half of the sponsor. He said, you know what, Nelson, let's do it. I mean, if you know, we don't know what's going to happen over here. If the freaking thing is a fiasco, we just leave. I mean, you know, let's give it a try. Let's, you know, I said, but we don't have the money. I said, I know we don't have the money, but let's just say we have it and we try to push it onwards and, you know, let's give it a try. I said, okay, fine. So I said, hey, okay, Adrian Campos, I have what you needed for, but I cannot pay you all now. We're going to have to wait for the sponsor money for it to come during the races. And he said, okay, I think I can convince the guys from China with this. So we go to the first race in Hong Kong. I said, look, the money is not going to come for the first. It's going to come more for the second race onwards. And I was planning a race. Okay, it's going to give me a chance to find more sponsorship, plus see if it's worth really spending the money on this whole crazy idea of electric racing. So we go to Hong Kong, disaster first weekend. I mean, it was horrible. The guys had no idea what they were doing. The teams that were Audis, the Renaults, the you know, the at the time they had the Virgin cars with Sam Bird. I mean, these teams were miles ahead of us. Oh, look, Steve, these guys have no idea what they're doing. We're going to, you know, it's going to be a waste of time over here, what we're doing. And he was like, well, let's give it a try. You know, I think I don't think we need the payment until the second race. I said, well, how are we going to get this payment? Well, let's try to push it on. Anyway, second race, Malaysia. They're putting pressure on us to bring the sponsor money ready. And I'm like, oh, it's going to come right after the race. Let's do this race and I'll give you the money afterwards. So managed to do the race. I was running third until I was taken out by Trulli. And I was like, whoa, we're running third this race already before getting taken out. You know, Steve, I mean, I think, you know, even though they're completely lost, all the cars are the same. So essentially, you know, I need to, you know, the cars are the same and you cannot touch anything. You know, you need to do energy management well done. You know, as long as I have someone to kind of teach me how to do a bit of energy management, I think I can do it. You know, okay, let's keep trying. Let's go to the third race, which was Punta or Buenos Aires, something like that. But by then, we were having a lot of pressure from China Racing to bring in the sponsor money. You know, they were calling in every day, emails. If you don't bring the money, we're gonna put a different driver. And we're like, no, we're gonna find out. So at that time, I'm pushing Qualcomm. Steve is pushing Qualcomm to get the money. And they look, guys, it's gonna come in January, what we promised you. Not before that. So I was like, fuck. We're talking about we're in November sort of period of the time, and I still had 3 months for the money to come. So I go to the bank and I get a loan, and knowing that this money was gonna come. So I get a loan and we send a bit of money to the team. I said, look, this is what we got for the moment and from the sponsor. And we'll give you a little bit more after Punta. And they were like, okay, so you do Punta. And after Punta, you really need to bring the money. Punta, we finished second place. the whole team went crazy. Wow, well done, well done. I said, well, that's going to be great. It's going to buy me a bit of time. And, well, the week after Punta, Nelson, where's the money? Where's the money? Fuck. We go to the bank, get another bit of loan, send the money. And then after we had Buenos Aires, so I managed to stay into Buenos Aires and got another podium, finished third over there, if I'm not mistaken. And the team went crazy. Oh, that's great, this and that. So it bought me a bit of time. And then same thing. Went to Miami to race in Miami. Got a lot of pressure. We were supposed to win that race, but we had a problem in the pit stop with the car. I was going to win that race easily. And I had a problem in the pit stop. Ending up finishing fifth. But at that time, I was already top five in the championship, if I'm not mistaken. And the Chinese guy, he was putting pressure for me to bring the money of the sponsors, but he was kind of, at that point, I had a little bit more of, I don't know how to say it in English, but I had a bit more of morale in the team to be able to say, hold on and this and that. Anyway, I'm sorry I'm making this thing so long, but we went to Long Beach and, you know, we were having pressure from the team to bring the rest of the money. And obviously we got the first win in Long Beach. And then the Chinese guy called me after the race, called me and said, oh, fuck, this is going to be my last race. That's it, you know. And because we were owing at that point so much money, because it was not only the money that we were, because I don't know if, like I said in the beginning, Qualcomm had agreed to only half of what I was supposed to bring to the team. So we were owing kind of quite a lot of money, and I was already calculating, okay, I need to win X amount of races to be able to pay this bill. I said, oh my God, what's going to happen? So this Chinese guy calls me into a dinner with Steve. And I was like, okay, well, Steve is going to be our last race. Say bye to everybody. And then he said, oh, well, you're doing really well. You know, we need sponsorship. I said, I know I'm trying, but it's not easy. And this, and I said, let's do this. And he had the contract in front of him. And he said, look, here's the contract. And he did a, he turned the paper. I said, oh, fuck. What now? He said, look, forget what you owe me. Stay until the end of the championship. Try to win it. And I'll, whatever you make in bonuses of all of these prize money, you can keep it.
Whoa.
I was like, oh, my God. I was like, thank God. Thank you so much. And I was all... So that was it. After Long Beach, you know, I finally was racing without any pressure, and we ended up winning the championship. And it was, you know, that's the story of season one, basically.
I've never heard that story. I don't know whether you've spoken about that before. If you have, I've just missed it. But that is such a cool story. And what a bloke to do that with it. I mean, what a great way for someone to react, to just rip up the contract and go, look, I can see your value. Forget it and keep the money. Take the bonus money. Yeah.
No, it was hard times. It was. I need to thank Steve a lot for that, because Steve really did. If it wasn't for him, it would have been much harder for me. But yeah, thanks to Qualcomm, thanks to Steve and Rebecca. I mean, all of these people that were helping me so much, you know, in that tough year. Yeah, and because of that, you know, and I'm going to continue a little bit into season two and three, just. But much in a much shorter version. Obviously, when the season ended, I had an opportunity to go to any of the teams. I could have picked to go to Virgin, to go to Venturi, to go to anywhere I wanted, and offer, and with good salaries. And because I don't know, I come from a small city, Brasilia, which it's a little bit different. I tend to say the big cities like New York, LA, Miami, Paris. You have much more shallow friendships and everything is money and you have a bit of a fake sort of world, you know? And I think I've learned how to appreciate a little bit friendship and opportunities. So I told Next TV, well, became Next TV in season two, but China Racing, I said, look, I'm not going to leave for any of these teams. Don't be worried about that. The only thing I'm going to ask you is to equal what they want to pay me. So if I'm going to get X amount of salary in that team, just equal it to me and we're good. We'll continue together and we'll keep this journey that it has started so beautifully and so crazy, but we made it. And so let's stick together. And we and the group of people that Adrian Campos put together was a really good group of guys. You know, it was really, we had a lot of fun together and it was really fun. The problem was that, that was my fault and Steve's fault. We didn't do our, we knew it, but we didn't know how bad it was going to be. Basically, the regulation of Formula E was first season, all the cars are going to be the same, but you can start developing your car for season two straight away. So the teams like Audi, Renault, all these big manufacturers, when the race one started in Hong Kong, they were already developing their powertrain for season two. Next TV, we were trying to put the pennies together to be able to fly to the races, be able to bring an engineer to the races, because they had no money, not even to pay for travel. You know, that was the situation we were. So thinking about developing of season two powertrain, forget about it. I mean, we didn't even know we were going to take part in season two, you know? So, obviously, when the season ended, you know, the Chinese bloke had got Martin Leach from Next TV to buy part of the team and to come in some money. But I had no idea we were a year behind everybody else in this whole development of the powertrain. Well, honestly, it's much easier to look back and you know, admit to mistakes that you have done.
Yeah,
but it was so frustrating what I did for the next two seasons, season two and three, that I really, it did change my career staying at China Racing, but I think it would have changed as well if I would have gone to a team like Virgin, for example, you know, and been able to fight for wins and championships and stuff like that. So it got me in a very frustrating streak of 2 years, until I managed to go to switch teams to Jaguar, which got a bit better, but still it was a very young team, which, you know, they still needed a lot of development still when I got there. But anyway, that's the beginning of Formula E for me.
Wow. Amazing stuff. And we should also obviously say, you know, you mentioned Adrian Campos there a lot.
Yes.
You know, thoughts to him, you know, who recently left us. So amazing to hear all that detail. So thank you so much for the honesty and openness there. It's brilliant stuff. We are running out of time. There's so much more we wanted to talk to you about, including your US exploits, truck racing, NASCAR, and your wins there, your debut NASCAR victory at Road America, becoming the first Brazilian to win a NASCAR National Touring Series event. There's so much more we need to talk to you about. So there's, as with one or two of our other guests, there's going to have to be a Nelson Piquet Jr. part two. But we'll whiz forward in the interest of time, Harry, if this is all right with you, just jumping into our final three, which we ask all of our guests, the same questions, they throw up different answers. I'll kick off. Nelson, what's got you excited at this very moment?
Well, obviously we're not in glory days of back in A1GP days or Formula E, anything like that, but I'm currently racing Brazilian touring cars and doing a couple of races, IMSA races in the States. But yeah, at the moment, honestly, I'm in a phase which I'm building a couple of companies in Brazil to be able to not depend on racing anymore. You know, obviously we're in that transition, which, you know, in a couple of years, I'm not going to be racing anymore, but I don't want to go through that period, which all these drivers, a lot of drivers go, which all of a sudden they don't have a ride and all of a sudden they're doing appearances for 2, 3, 5 grand, 10 grand, whatever, to survive. And that's not really what I would like to go through. So I'm trying to build as much as I can on the side for the racing to be 100% pleasure and just, you know, fun and not having to deal with payment contracts and negotiations. No, I just want to be racing for fun, you know, and I have all my businesses on the side taking care of all the bills that I have, basically.
Yeah, sounds very sensible. But if not doing what you're doing, which was being a racing driver, what would you have done?
I have no clue. Because, my father, as much as you always helped us a lot to achieve our dreams, he also, in a way, never really obliged or pushed us, and when I say us, it's because I see between all the brothers, to really do something meaningful or want to do something. My father, being a father and wanting to help the kids and, you know, not, I mean, he's been tough for a lot of things, but in other ways, he's not tough enough, you know, and that caused to, you know, a lot of my brothers and sisters not to be driven in doing much, you know, and so I would never want to be in that position. I'm so happy that I love racing, that I have this fire inside me to work, and I have a beverage company, I have restaurants, I have go-kart tracks, I mean, invested in different things. But it's all things that I love to do, and I work a lot, really a lot. But it's not something, I don't know, I haven't picked that up from my dad. And I see a lot of my brothers and sisters, which, you know, they haven't found their passion, they don't do much, and they kind of live a little bit, some of them live on my father still. So I think that, you know, I'm just glad that, you know, I've, what's your question again? Sorry.
If you weren't a racing driver, what would you be doing?
Oh yeah. So I don't know. I love working in the business. I don't know, commercial side of things. I'm very interested, buying, selling, marketing department. I don't know. I'm obviously, because my whole life I've been chasing sponsors and doing interviews and selling myself, and, you know, that I've kind of become good and I like doing that, you know? So I think, you know, something in the lines of selling, merchandise, marketing, I don't know. I still think that I would be a really good manager nowadays, because I've seen obviously everything that I've went through, that I know exactly what a driver needs to be 100% well-focused in the race car.
Good, yeah, good stuff. Well, there's certainly a spot on the Motormouth board for Nelson Piquet Jr., so I'm just going to just chuck that out there, see where it lands. Final question for you before we let you get on with your day. Nelson, what are you scared of?
What am I scared of? I don't know. I mean, not much. I mean, obviously, I think, I don't know, but I think quitting racing, you know, it's something that I would never want to do. You know, I know we're all getting old together. You know, we're all getting older. But, you know, I don't think about it, but at the same time, when I think about it, one day I'm going to have to start racing, it's not scary, but it's like, I wouldn't want to stop racing, you know? At the same time, there's drivers doing Stock Car Brazil that are 50 still, like Rubens. So it's something good to look at. Oh, I still have 15 years of racing ahead of me. Great. You know? But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Scared of getting hurt and not being able to race. I don't know. I mean, there's honestly, I don't know what I'm scared of.
But I think it's a whole new phase of life, isn't it, that people, I suppose, might be scared of. It's a new chapter that is going to be turned eventually, but you just don't know when that'll happen. But look, Nelson Piquet Jr., it's been an absolute pleasure. It really has been a privilege to have you on the show with us to kickstart our Season 8 of the podcast. Thank you so much for being so open and honest. The stories have been absolutely fascinating, and your career has been absolutely incredible, the ups and the downs. And I'm sorry we couldn't cover all of it, but hopefully...
That's all good.
As Tim said, we will get a part two in at some point soon. But Nelson Piquet Jr., thank you so much for coming onto the Motormouth podcast.
It's a pleasure. And I'll speak to you guys then on part two. Take care. Thank you very much.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the sport. Official ticket packages, which include the best race tickets, first-class hotels, travel and exclusive behind-the-scenes access across a Grand Prix weekend, F1 Experiences offer packages like no other. So to book your F1 Experiences package, head online to f1experiences.com
And if you enter code Motormouth, you'll get 5% off too. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.